You're listening to Girovagando by the Cycling Podcast. Today we are in Bocca della Selva.
Cozze, citere, cozze, cozze, piscine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora. Cozze, citere, cozze, cozze, piscine, non spigudeci ora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Chiama lei?
Io mi chiamo Pietro.
Pietro di cognome?
Pietro De Filippo.
E mi ha appena detto che ha fatto il campionato del mondo in che anno?
È nel 1979.
Sì.
Città del Messico, io ero juniores e quindi ho partecipato con...
Brian, it is tradition for us to start in the following manner. With a big old,
oh, that was seen
a big old, very aggressive clink to represent, signify the fact that we are back with a bang after our rest day. A lot more about the rest day later. Brian, the first voice we heard tonight, well, if it wasn't my voice, the other voice we heard belonged to a gentleman who I apprehended, I suppose, very close to where we're currently drinking our post-race non-alcoholic aperitivo. And that gentleman was Pietro De Filippo, a local fan who had ridden to watch the Giro d'Italia, lives pretty close to here. I asked him whether he was a cycling fan, how much cycling he did, and then he revealed to me that he had actually ridden the World Championships as a junior in 1979. He said it was in Mexico City. I did check where the Junior World Championships were in 1979. They were in Buenos Aires. I think he meant 1980 when it was in Mexico City. And Pietro then informed me that, well, he still rides, not with the same vigor that he once did, partly because, well, mainly because 10 years ago he had a heart and kidney transplant.
Ooh.
And he's taken on some pretty big rides since then. I think he rode down to Puglia from here. He now gets around on an electric bike, a Pozzo Vivo fan. Hopes were raised for a while, certainly while I was standing here when the race was going past. We're about 21, 22 kilometers from the finish. And it is notable, Brian, when you do sort of stand at the roadside in places like this, we're in the south still, we're in Campania, and Pietro actually told me this is one of the sort of remotest backwaters of Italian cycling. There is not a whole lot of cycling culture around here, and it is notable, Brian, that the fans don't necessarily know that many of the riders. A couple of names that I did hear in the crowd were Pozzovivo and Pogacar. Not too many others, I must say.
Interesting.
Yes, Brian, but it's a beautiful spot, isn't it? Describe the scene if you can. I mean, describe, well, the cavalcade passing before our eyes.
Yeah, all the team cars are still coming down from, I mean, the finish, as you mentioned, was further up the road somewhat. And on the other side, we're sort of sitting on top of a valley, and we have the ridge. It almost looks a little bit like, you know, sort of the Rhone Alps of France. You know, rocks with sort of greenish wooden areas here and there.
Yeah, not dissimilar to the Bourges, not far from Chambéry, in fact.
Yeah,
Chambéry. Speaking of which, that neck of the woods that will give us our stage winner today, without giving too much away. But Brian, are we refreshed after our rest day? It wasn't a very restful rest day, I must say. We'll discuss this later on. It should have been. I had high hopes for this rest. And it was a rewarding...
One always has.
Yeah, it was a memorable rest day, but not necessarily restful.
Very true. They always tend to be that way, so I wasn't expecting rest. I was also, when I woke up this morning, rest days make you more tired than race days. I think some riders would agree with that, even though our energy expenditure... I think my calorie count yesterday was higher than what
I had a lot of fried food yesterday, which is very unusual for me.
Yeah, I noticed that when I met up with you later on at a restaurant. But yeah, I mean, we need those rest days, I suppose, also for logistical reasons. the Giro's probably also starting to take its toll on our second vehicle of the race.
That's true.
But I think we'll try and keep that one until the end.
It still doesn't have a name yet. There have been some pretty good suggestions. Bananito was one, given that we called the first one Darwin, or Darwin Atapuma. Bananito, of course, Carlos Betancourt. Blanco, Whitey was another one, wasn't it? And Brian, one bit of good news for the day is that we avoided the eruption of the super volcano, although the lava fall could still probably stretch to where we are now. We're still in Campania, but we seem to have escaped the wrath of the super volcano.
Well, I saw the effects of one this morning.
Yeah, well, I was about to say, we started in Pompeii, and you visited Pompeii. Lionel and I went a couple of years ago, and so I left it to you today.
Yeah, it was. I've been in the area quite a bit, but I've never seen Pompeii with my own eyes. And what an incredible place! I mean, we all, heard about the eruption of Vesuvio during our time in school, I suppose. But just seeing it and seeing how, it gives you a real insight into what Roman life, at least the aristocratic or of sort, the Roman life looked like at the time. But it also gave me a little bit thought that my maybe not so unnatural fear about the next eruption of a super volcano is there's all kinds of things that we're starting to become aware of, I think, especially with the younger generations, about what can possibly go wrong. But this one is not due to anything in terms of climate change or man-made disturbances. It's just this sleeping catastrophe. And the population there around that area is obviously a lot more dense today. A lot more people will be in harm's way if something like that happens again.
Brian, we should get on to the cycling, but just before we do, we said we started in Pompeii, or the stage started in Pompeii today. Not the first time Giro has started there. I was reading about discussing with our good friend Herbie Sykes one previous occasion when the Giro started in Pompeii, 1974, and it saw an epic battle between Fuente, the Spanish climber, and Eddie Merckx, documented on a very famous film, The Greatest Show on Earth, about the 1974 Giro d'Italia. And it features a little known sort of unheralded climb that I sort of got quite excited about, particularly given that we were staying at the bottom of that mountain and the Monti Latari in general. It's a climb that I don't think it's featured in the Giro since then. Monte Faito was where the battle really took place, on the stage from Pompeii to Sorrento, and that really signified, well, it was the first year when Carmine Castellano, who went on to become the Giro director, had a big hand in arranging some of the stages, and particularly the southern stages. Why was that? Well, Vincenzo Torriani, who was the boss of the Giro d'Italia back then, and he was an aviophobe, Brian. He hated flying, so he recruited someone to do his travelling in the south, to look at stages, seek out new routes. And this Monte Faito, which, it's sort of a mountain opposite Vesuvius, overlooking the Bay of Naples. You can still ride up it. It's still in pretty good condition, I'm led to believe. Not much traffic, which is a rarity in that region. Yeah. And as I say, it plays host to this fantastic battle, which you will see if you do watch The Greatest Show on Earth.
I have my own theory about why the bike race doesn't need to cast attention on that area.
Let's save all discussion about local colour for later in the podcast. Let's proceed, shall we, with the Processo alla Tappa.
Il Processo alla Tappa, the post-stage inquisition.
We've established we started in Pompeii. Where did the stage go and how long was it, please?
It was a short one, Daniel. It's finished in Cusano Mutri, which is actually where we're staying now, where there was an intermediate sprint, but the finish line as such was up on the climb of Bocca della Selva. Maybe they added that because no one knew where Cusano Mutri was, but anyways, that was the finish line of today.
Brian, was there a breakaway today?
Daniel, there were many breakaways today, and there was also the key to the stage win, but a very big and very a group with a lot of horsepower went away, consisted of 26 riders, something like that would in a normal Grand Tour context ring all kinds of bells and alarms and whatnot. But they actually, and we'll probably get to that later, they actually got a pretty big gap, which then eventually meant that more than one team wanting to chase, because even if Pogacar wasn't threatened, I mean, what is he really threatened by other than illness? There were other riders who had some concern probably about their own position in the GC. So UAE didn't do all the pulling today. Team Ineos, Grenadiers chipped in, and Bahrain did as well. It split several times, that group, but the significant split sort of happened when Visma Lisa Bikes Jan Tratnik went away. Looked like he...
Where was that, Brian?
38 kilometers from the finish. And Ryder started to drop there as well. And after he went away, the group got split again. Valentin Paré-Peintre, Marco Frigo, Andrea Bagioli, Romain Bardet, and Filippo Fiorelli went after him. Eventually, it was only Paré-Peintre and Romain Bardet who were able to keep up the chase. And I sort of sat with having the feeling that Tratnik would finish the job. He's such a silent achiever and someone that has like a high level throughout the season, and this looked like his big Giro success, second for them, if so, because Sula Koi won before
cuddly,
the rest.
Cuddly but lethal. If I had to propose a nickname for Jan Tratnik, it would be something like the Atomic Teddy Bear.
Yeah, that's... Well, I'm not going to compete with that because that's just about perfect. But what wasn't perfect for him was that once Bardet, and it looked like Bardet and Valentin Paré-Peintre, they sort of agreed to jump away from Andrea Bagioli of Lille Trek, and they did. But then eventually it turned out that Paré-Peintre was the stronger of those two. And even if Bardet sort of fought his way back, it was too late. And Valentin Paré-Peintre, the younger of the two brothers, won the stage.
Brian, can you give me the result of the stage, please? Give me at least five riders.
Yeah, so
maybe 10.
Paré-Peintre won. Romain Bardet, 29 seconds on second spot. Tratnik still stayed away from the others, apart from those two. He was third, a minute down. Andrea Bagioli, fourth. And the older of the two Paré-Peintre brothers, Aurélien, was 125 seconds behind. And can I just mention that then the remains of the breakaway, or those who were still sitting out there, came after that. And in the GC battle, just very briefly, the first rider in a bigger group that split us eventually as well was Ben O'Connor at 3 minutes and 14.
Brian, do you want to go into more detail about the various sort of movements in the general classification group now, or should we do that? Let's save that for later. Can you just tell me who were the big movers on general classification? Because there were a couple,
yep,
and they came from the group. There were a couple of riders who recouped a lot of ground.
Yeah, most importantly, Romain Bardet, second on the stage, he jumped seven spots on the GC from 14th to 7th. Filippo Sanna of Team Jacques Alula jumped four places and he's now into top 10, being 13th before today. Anne Rubio, two down. Arnsman, two down. Jan Hirt, two down. Storer, two down. Alex Boudin, two down. And then just minor ups and downs, but none that are important for GC purposes.
In that case, Brian, can you remind us of the top five in the general classification, please?
I certainly can. Pogacar still leads the race, 2 minutes and 42. Danny Martinez. Geraint Thomas, 2:58 on third. Ben O'Connor, fourth, 3:39. Sian Utebrooks, 4:15 on fifth. And after him, I just have to mention that Antonio Tiberi at 4:27.
Kian Utebrook still holds the white jersey. He's the leader of the youth classification, the white jersey competition. But Tiberi did narrow the gap today. He's now just 12 seconds adrift. And Filippo Zanna, don't forget, is also in that competition. And he is only 1 minute and 8 seconds down now as a result of the time he gained today. Brian, traditionally at the end of the Processo alla Tappa, you ask me a question. What is that question?
That question is, Daniel, who'd you talk to today and what did they say?
We're about to hear from Jan Tratnik. It's all Slovenians today. Jan Tratnik and the Pink Panther himself. I think we called him the Snow Leopard the other day, but it's not. It's an unsatisfactory. It's not a nickname as yet, but we're going to come up with something by the end of the Giro. And Tadej Pogacar, I slightly miffed Tadej Pogacar.
I showed them that I'm strong and maybe they would lose hope. But yeah, in the end, it was a really long climb and to be already before alone, I can be still satisfied with performance. But yeah, honestly, they were stronger, and I gave my maximum and I'm really happy.
You are still smiling. That's a good sign, right, for the future of the Giro?
I think better that I'm crying.
No regrets today?
No.
Grazie mille, bravo.
Thank you.
Yeah, very satisfied. One more day ticked off. And it was actually super hard stage, fast, and at the beginning hot, then humid, and now it's cold. It was a really, really strange day, but we survived it good, really good with the team, and we're looking forward for the next days. Today was not, you couldn't do really anything today. It was not a day that you do this kind of tactic when you have one teammate in front, and you chase each other down, and it was not this kind of day. I think the others just try to go for the stage, I think, and I think that's all, yeah.
What do you mean by Tiviri is the only one who's showing some balls?
Because he's the only one that that has been on the attack on last two mountain stages, actually. So, today Bahrain did the most of the work on the last final climb. So, I must say that he is really good, and I admire him that he showed courage, I wish him also the good legs the next days.
The cycling podcast at the 2024 Giro d'Italia is supported by MAP, cycling apparel.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Well, Brian, the evening sun still peeking over the rooftops here in Cusano Mutri. We have been invaded, or the bar has been invaded, by the local police, men and women who are finishing their day's work on the Giro d'Italia. Still a lot of movement, a lot of people at the roadside watching the vehicles come down towards the team buses. And today, Brian, they saw an exciting stage. Perhaps not the stage that a lot of sort of hardened cycling fans would have liked to have seen, not the GC battle that probably the likes of Mauro Vegni might have wanted. When we talk about the architecture of this race, and we have talked about it a lot, it was noticeable just looking at the general profile that the second week did always look like a bit of a hiatus. However, it was bookended by mountain stages. Start of the week today down south, and the end of the week, of course, we've got that queen stage to Livigno, which Tadej Pogacar has already described as the hardest stage he has ever done or will do. We didn't see too much change. We saw subtle differences, subtle sort of signs of what might come on the general classification. But the battle for the stage win was an exciting one. We will come on later, I think, to why that battle for the stage win didn't feature any general classification riders, why there were two separate races today, effectively. Now, you said in the Processo alla Tappa there was a very strong group, and it was about 30 riders, wasn't it? One thing I noticed immediately, Brian, was the number of teams who had multiple riders. And there are some teams that are very good at this. DSM, Firmenich Post NL, over the past 3 or 4 years, when they have had success in breakaways, in major tours, this has been a feature. Do you know what else has been a feature? The presence of Chris Hamilton. Chris Hamilton has got a lot of assists in his day.
It's true.
He hasn't won a Grand Tour stage himself yet, but he's often the guy when a break goes away and a stronger rider or his team captain is there. He's doing vital work to tee that team captain up. And it looked at one point as though Romain Bardet was going to be teed up for the stage win. He did gain time and gained 7 places, we said, on general classification. He actually, Brian, after the finish today, said that he had terrible legs today. And he had really sort of suffered the restart after the giorno di riposo, after the rest day. So it was another Frenchman who I would say, Brian, was clearly the strongest and looked like clearly the strongest from about 15 or 20 kilometres in, Valentin Paris-Peintre. He has had less attention of the two Paris-Peintre brothers. He's the younger of the two. He's a bit more of a pure climber. He considers himself to be more of a pure climber than his brother Aurélien, who of course won a stage, and it was a mountain stage in the south of Italy in the Giro d'Italia last year at Lago Lacino. And do you know what, Brian? That was also in Campania.
Well, there you go. I mean, there's also a difference in, not just in age, but also in height. And you can see with Valentin that he, as you said, he's probably one of the climbers that looks most like a pure climber. Mm. I think he did it really smart, because when Trattning went away, he didn't overdo it. So he also made sure that Bardet did his share of the work, and I think that also paved the way a little bit for his possibilities to do the attack. And he probably also sensed, even, you know, it sounds ironic to say that, oh, I had terrible legs, but he finished twice and was in the breakaway all day. But maybe also those little signs that only bike riders see when they sit next to someone, how they pedal and how they can hear their breathing, possibly could also have had an influence on how and when he wanted to attack for the win.
Brian, it's just occurred to me, are you familiar with, there's a pizza chain? I don't know how big this pizza chain is. They certainly exist in the UK. Fratelli La Bufala.
No.
Okay, the Bufala brothers. Bufala refers to Bufala mozzarella. And mozzarella, well, the best mozzarella comes from this part of the world, Campania. So the Fratelli La Bufala, maybe an alternative nickname for the Paris-Peintre brothers. But this was a continuation of the fantastic year that Decathlon Agir d'Auxerre are having. And Annus Mirabilis, I think you have to say at this point, Brian. We've heard a lot about it from our good friend, the Motown Maestro, Larry Warbass. We'll be hearing again from Larry about the very good Giro that he's having later on. But two extremely promising riders, Valentin, only 23 years of age. Is this his first major tour?
It is. Is it? Well, it's his first win also as a professional.
Really? First win as a professional? That surprises me, actually.
Well, he came out strong from the Tour of the Alps. He finished four on GC. Has he won? No, sorry. He won a stage as a Ronde du Soir.
Wait, le Ronde du Soir. Yeah, a stage in the Ronde de l'Isard in 2020. Ronde de l'Isard is one of those sort of key proving grounds for under-23 riders in France, and, well, international riders as well. Very big names.
Yeah, he was still riding for his for Chambéry Cyclisme, so the club, the local club of his.
So a man going places, a family going places. I remember last year, Brian, when the Tour de France started in Annemasse, where they're from. And this is a bit of a cycling dynasty, this family. I'm not sure whether it's both parents. Certainly their father was a cyclist, has been an amateur cyclist. And Aurélien was able to point to his sort of bedroom window of the apartment he grew up in from the mix zone, from the start, the Tour de France in Annemasse. Last year, I read earlier that Valentin started riding his bike when he was 6.5 years old, Brian.
Didn't you?
No, I did not. Well, a bike. Yeah, I suppose I did. I suppose I did, actually. But I got the impression this was like serious riding. It's not just like flouncing around on a BMX.
I hope not that anyone is doing serious riding at 6.5.
I think you're doing intervals at 7.5.
But I can stand corrected if you find the photos that didn't happen.
Yeah. VO2 max efforts at age 7. Brian, that was the battle for the stage. And as I said, we'll hear from Larry later on. But Brian, I said that this group was able to stay away, and we got the stage that we did because of something that had happened behind. We weren't exactly sure when we were watching the stage what UAE were thinking, wanting to do. We saw them pulling for most of the stage, but it did become clear. So initially, Alessandro De Marchi and Simon Clark were down the road. Then this bigger group formed, and there was sort of 20 minutes or so, or half an hour, when we weren't really sure whether UAE were keeping them sort of on a tight leash, or whether they were letting them go out, whether maybe UAE were trying to give the jersey away. That was another sort of consideration at one point. And then eventually, in the fullness of time, it became clear that UAE were not going to contest the stage win with Pogacar. then...
But I also wanted to add, maybe this is what you're aiming at as well, that whatever they did, it lured the other teams out to pull. Because the first teams that are under pressure when the big group goes away like that are the riders immediately behind Pogacar. So it would eventually mean at some point, and that's, it's vague to really say when do other teams start pulling. And I know there are certain people who are more of the ilk that, oh, they should just let UAE spend all the energy in. But also there's other people who have other interests to protect. And if Bardet goes up the road and gets 11 minutes, it is a real problem for Geraint Thomas. It is a real problem for Ben O'Connor, and it certainly is a real problem as well for Tiberi and Uijtebroeks. So cycling is a very hard competition, but you also find common interests before the race is decided, as we saw today.
So, Brian, why did UAE let that group go away and stay away? Well, Tadej Pogacar told us in his press conference that it was essentially a diplomatic move by UAE. And not only that, he wasn't thrilled about the whole situation. He was asked a couple of days ago, and we spoke to him, we asked him in the press conference as well, about this sort of growing feeling in the peloton that he is becoming a bit of a cannibal and he's leaving crumbs for everyone else, meager crumbs for everyone else, and that maybe not this needs to stop, but that it would be in his interest and in his team's interest to be a little bit more generous. It sounded, from what he said in the press conference, as though there were more conversations to that effect, maybe in the bunch today, and there was a certain pressure exerted on him and on UAE to let that break go, and he said he wasn't happy about it. I mean, I'll just read the quotes to make sure I'm getting this exactly right. It's not about if I can win or not. In the end, we rode easy and then Bahrain had to pull. They set a hard pace on the climb. We were not in control of the climb anymore. In my opinion, it would have been better just to go how we wanted to the finish, but sometimes there's too many people in the peloton saying we need to share a piece of the pie. It's just that sometimes you can grab the option and sometimes you cannot. Today was 50-50. I would say at Prati di Tivo, it was more easy to take it. Sometimes you don't need to force your team and yourself for the stage win. How's the stage? She was asked. If I'm honest, I would say in a nice way that everyone is happy.
Yeah, but with the Slovenian parenthesis, that not including him. I also have to say, I'm getting a little bit sort of mixed messages here from himself. Because speaking of Prati di Tivo, his team, not heeded, decided that they were going for it. And he said, well, they were the ones who were supposed to do the work. And if they wanted to take it a little bit easy, he would have totally been fine with that. I'm hearing different things today, but this is under the influence of other teams in the peloton. And when it comes to that, I think it was a cool thing that he let the team decide, and when, especially when he's able to finish the job. I don't agree that other teams should have an opinion about how he rides. They can have that. I'm sure they have, obviously. But he should ride how he wants to. He will then have to deal with the consequences. Could also be, maybe not here at the Giro, but at some point at the Tour, that if someone has sort of a little bit of a, what would you call, like an issue with how he's been racing here and in other races, they might not be nice to him at the Tour. He might not care about that at all, but instrumentally it could be an issue. But I'm definitely of the opinion that a champion or anyone, a team, that's what they're here for. You ride however you want to, and if you want to win, you go for it.
Yeah, and there are different ways to do diplomacy as well and play politics. One way is with your team tactics, but there are other ways, like, for example, just the way you interact with other riders. And I think he's pretty successful at being popular, making himself popular in the way he interacts with other
riders. I mean, after Catalunya, there was a social media phenomenon where they talked about he won, 5 out of 7 stages there or something like that. And he should let more breakaways go, and why is he putting his team up? I'm like, don't forget that. He said that in an earlier press conference here at the race as well. He's paid to perform. He's paid to win. He also wants to pay back the work that his teammates do and all of that. And I think we sort of lose the real genuine feeling of what professional sport is about if we have a vote about what type of racing we're going to see. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion.
Brian, given that the stage win was minutes down the road.
And also, last thing, none of those other riders would do the same in his position. They would race to win, right? I mean, that there's just a difference between being able to and not being.
Brian, playing devil's advocate, could he nonetheless, because the other issue here is entertainment and the duty, and I think he feels this keenly as well, the duty to entertain and the imperative that he feels to entertain. Given the breakaway was down the road and the stage win had gone, could he nonetheless, should he nonetheless have attacked and offered and, you know, given us a bit of a show behind? Because he looked very, I mean, the last two mountain stages, it's looked as though, I won't say he's pedaling with one leg, but he's looked very comfortable.
I mean, if his participation in the show today would be about gaining more time with the stage win out of the question, gaining more time on his of his rivals, I think that would be pointless at where we are in the race. However, imagine if Bahrain and Ineos, and this is me being the devil's advocate here, weren't strong enough to keep that break under control, and all of a sudden they had 7-8 minutes. His team would have had to work a lot harder, and I think that's what he means with we lost control of the climb, because it could have been too late and it could have been potentially a problem. So that's also a way to dose your effort from the UAE to say, okay, we're going to ride this tempo now, and we're comfortable with that, we're sitting where we need to be in front of the peloton, and we have everything under control. And I think when you have a leader's jersey, not having that feeling of control obviously depends on the psychology between him and the sports director and how they interpret it. But I just don't think he likes to not be in control.
Brian, I also asked him in the press conference to compare his current sort of state of fatigue to other Grand Tours that he's done. Because as I say, it has been my impression in the last three or four stages that he has been pretty comfortable. I suppose, you know, there are two things here. There's what he actually thinks and feels and what he's going to tell the media. And he told us that they're all pretty much the same, these Grand Tours. And then he gave a fairly detailed answer actually about the condition one finishes a Grand Tour in. He described it as a kind of chronic fatigue that takes 2 weeks to recover from, which, you know, is kind of interesting in light of what he's attempting this year and his dual objective of also winning the Tour de France.
But also don't forget that when he came back from altitude before Liège, he crushed everyone at Liège. So he excuse me, he must have been pretty near, at least I would hope so for his rivals, pretty near the best he could be.
And say al dente, because we're going to talk about Pastor in a minute.
Yeah, definitely al dente, but more al dente in the Lazio type of al dente, where they do undercook it a little bit, in my opinion. But that's a long stretch of being able to perform at such a high level, and that's probably also his concern. So yeah, it's I'm getting a little bit mixed messages here, but if nothing else, if it wasn't for the excitement of the race, a little bit of polemica, and there's more to come, I believe, with that. So
there is a bit of polemica. It's not our polemica, but it was polemica which I felt was being sort of falsely created and falsely inflated on the real Processo alla Tappa. Not our Processo alla Tappa, but we're talking about the post-race show on Rai, the Italian state.
Well, there's even a meta-polemica to that that might contextualize the polemica in the show.
Yeah, I don't think we should go into that. But on the Processo alla Tappa on Rai, obviously the centre of attention is Antonio Tiberi, because he is the sole Italian representative in the upper echelons of the general classification. Of course, this is a rider who has had his issues, and these issues, I think, are have been less sort of readily forgiven and forgotten abroad than they are being in Italy. I think most listeners know what we're talking about. We'll describe it as the cat incident. But he is rehabilitating himself, has rehabilitated himself to a large degree. Must say that all the reports I hear about people who know him and have dealings with him speak very favourably of him as a young man, and certainly the way he conducts himself, or the way he has conducted himself over the last few months. And Brian, not only that, but he's a damn good bike rider. And he was attacking again today. He attacked at Prati di Tivo. He's now locked in this quite intriguing, quite engrossing, really. And it's, you're always sort of loath to have to, you know, switch your focus and attention away from the, you know, the Maglia Rosa. That's what we're really interested in, these sort of minor classifications. It's thin gruel by comparison. However, this is quite an exciting little duel that has been set up. And there's also a third rider, terzo incomodo, as the Italians would say, Filippo Zana. And Tiberi's attacks today, Brian, in the finale, I mean, to me, they looked as though the main goal was to unhinge, drop Kian Uterbrooks, more than to put pressure on other riders who are competing for those sort of podium positions.
Do need to mention, I think, Filippo Sanna, he is 25. This is his last chance for the white jersey. Mm. But either way, I see those two as you mentioned, the central of the... I wouldn't at this point call it a default classification or GC battle because Pogacar is so good. But we have a 21-year-old rider and a 22-year-old rider who are putting each other under pressure and testing each other at any given time. Part of it, I think, is that Tiberi feels like he wants the white jersey. He said that as well. But it comes as a bonus when you're the better of those two riders. Mm. I think they're more in contention than Filippo Sanna is. Either way, the discussion, I think, just coming back to that on the Processo d'Etappe was that, is he spending too much energy? And there was, it was almost like a throwback to times, Processo dell'Etappe of yesteryears, where there was just one big discussion with open microphones all along. And they were certainly not agreeing today whether that was a wise move of him to attack. You know, he lost a little bit of time when Ben O'Connor sprinted towards the line and all that. And that's sort of that is a default polemica. But the real core of it is how interesting it will be to see those two fight it out, because they are riders of the future.
Brian, this morning I spoke to Antonio Tiberi, and I didn't speak to Kian Uterbrooks, but I did speak to his direct sportif, Mark Rafe, who gave me some interesting insight into Uterbrooks, the start of his Giro d'Italia, and also the start of his career at Visma Lisabike.
Antonio, so obviously it's been a great first week for you. The Italians are very excited about you. You're their best hope at the moment. How are you dealing with the pressure of being the sort of centre of attention?
I really like this feeling, you know, because I'm lucky to don't suffer a lot of the pressure or something like this. I can stay calm, and I use this pressure to put more power on the pedals.
And obviously you're right in the battle for the white jersey. Is that where your focus is, or is your focus on the high position anyway, disregarding Uterbrooks? Where's your focus for the next 2 weeks?
My focus is to try to go more up as possible on the GC. Maybe try to go on the podium. It's my dream. And the white jersey maybe is coming with this other objective. But for sure also the white jersey. I'm thinking a lot about this. And I won't try to get it.
On Kian and his first week, well, just generally speaking, how satisfied have you been with his race so far?
Really satisfied. We started with the free roll for him in GC, with the main focus on GC results, stage results. So with that being our focus, the rest of the... We also wanted to protect him and keep him safe. And on several occasions, I think we did that on a good way. Also, he was there where he needed to be on the uphill finishes. He also showed a really high level. He did a good TT. It's always difficult up front to know what can you expect in terms of time losses or certain situations. But I think that he can be proud, and we are proud that he's now in this situation, that he... In the hectic, he was all the time there. That he could also defend his GC at several occasions already, and that we went through the first week actually without any big problems according him. And that he's now 15 GC, having the white jersey. That's more than we expected already up front.
There was this impression of him before he joined the team that he's very demanding, and that he's also a guy who at a very young age has squeezed a lot out of himself. He's worked on himself a lot. Weighs his food, that kind of thing. And what do you see as a big area where he could improve and he will improve?
I think on that part, exactly how you say it.
Too stressed?
Not too stressed, but he really wants to do well, and he's really motivated. He's highly ambitious, and when you put too much, in Dutch we say te, if you just put a small word of it, then it can also flip the other way around. And to find that balance, I think that's the biggest step he can make at this moment in terms of his personality. I mean, he's on a good way in the group. It's a nice guy. He's friendly. He's also grateful to the team and to his teammates. And I think when you look sportive-wise, yeah, then of course, in general, being a 21-year-old guy, he can develop on a lot of ways. He can still become stronger. He can still improve his TT. He can still improve being a leader. He can still improve in the mountains, descending. Just in the whole broad of being a cyclist, he can still improve. But I think as a person, just what I said, that's the biggest step he can make still.
It's hard to tell someone to do less, though, isn't it? It's hard to say, well, you are doing too, you know, just relax a little bit. You don't have to be as professional as you are currently being, in a way.
You have to hit your nose. That's also Dutch, but you have to bump your head. That's maybe better at some occasions. Then being open to evaluate about it, and then give insights to that person. And at some occasions, it happened already in the past where we can now reflect on. But also this year, it happened already once, and yeah, that makes them also. I think that that you could see it in the results in the lead towards the Giro.
I do remember it. What, tell me the race.
Nah, it was more that in the whole broad of the first part of the season. Eh, in Tirreno, he was still there, but in Catalunya, it flipped the other way. And that's not that you can put really a finger. Okay, that is it. But just in the whole width of being a cyclist and training and performing, and just sometimes when you want too much, then it can flip the other way around.
Brian. Very intriguing what Mark Rees said about Kian Uytterbroeks. We sort of knew that he's a rider who's putting a lot of pressure on himself, and he's trying to extract the absolute most of himself in every kind of area of how he goes about his business as a professional rider. And it's something that maybe, it's a fine balance, a fine sort of equilibrium that he has to find between pushing, stressing, demanding a lot of himself, and also just sort of accepting and relaxing, I suppose. But we will follow that with interest over the next few days. The mental approach to professional cycling, Brian. I had a few conversations about that this morning. One was with Alessandro De Marchi, who on his rest day had a consultation with his mental coach. He was telling me about that. He's been working with a mental coach for 2-3 years now. It worked in the sense he got in the break today. We'll check in with Alessandro in the next couple of days to see, to get a bit of a debriefing from him about today and whether he was able to implement everything his mental coach told him yesterday. But Brian, this is becoming a sort of a common thing to do on rest days, to check in with your mind guru, mental coach, psychologist. Another rider who did just that was a good friend, teammate of the stage winner today, lucky Larry Warbass, the Motan Maestro. And today's instalment of La Ranzando is a long one, but I think you'll agree, an interesting one from Pompeii this morning.
La Ranzando, a postcard from Italy, with Larry Warbass.
Thank you. Larry, sorry to keep you waiting.
No,
how are you? How was your rest day?
Yeah, it was nice. it was pretty restful. So yeah, I mean, just the usual.
Do you not find it stressful around here? I find it incredibly stressful in this part of Italy. Everything, the cars, the noise, it just never switches off.
Yeah, I can't say. I mean, actually, it was kind of funny because won't say we had the best hotel. We haven't actually had any good hotels this whole Giro yet. But you know, it's not like the cycling podcast. Unfortunately, we don't get to choose our logement. But yeah.
Accommodation was in a mafia stronghold of a town I've been reading about since we booked it, and reflecting I probably shouldn't have stayed there. But anyway, go on,
really?
Larry.
Well, I doubt they're too concerned about Daniel Freeb, but
you say that.
You never know. But yeah, I don't know. It was like kind of funny because the stage was super stressful going into Napoli. It was super dangerous, you know, going into the final, everything. Then, you know, we're driving back to the hotel. The bus driver gets lost, takes a wrong turn. Then, like, he can't get into the parking. It takes him forever. We go into the hotel, and there's, like, a wedding, okay? So our wedding or some very large party, it was kind of like an events hall and small hotel. And so then it was just, like, this DJ and some guy singing, like, live music. And it was, like, we were sitting right next to, like, this banquet hall, right? So, you know, it was super loud. So it was, yeah, really not that restful. And then we finished dinner. Finally, the music ends. And then we're like, oh, okay, it's calm. And then fireworks start going off outside. And it was just fireworks, fireworks, fireworks. And honestly, it was pretty funny. And so, yeah. And then, you know, we thought, okay, that's gone. And then last night, I was getting a treatment from the osteo. And the door was open. And I just hear it sounded like, I mean, it sounded like we were in the middle of, like, a school lunch hall. And an entire school arrived at the hotel, and so yeah, it was a bunch of kids. So I can't say it was exactly the most restful, but anyway, I feel more rested today than I did 2 days ago. So I think that's a positive sign.
Sounds like a sort of quintessentially Southern Italian scene, Larry. Yeah. All of that. Do you consider yourself? This is a strange question. Do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert, Larry? Because I feel
An extrovert.
Okay. Yeah. Because if you're an introvert, I think you struggle with this part of Italy. Because we're introverts, so I consider myself an introvert. We're overstimulated,
yeah,
and we need to turn the dial down. Whereas you extroverts, you want to turn the dial up.
I think Ben can probably relate. Yeah, but for me, I also like calm. You know. I like being in peaceful places and relaxing, even if I'm an extrovert and like talking to people, you know? But
your home is very peaceful. It's a bit of a sanctuary.
Exactly. See? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was thinking about that yesterday. I was like, yeah, being at home's a hell of a lot more restful than where I am right now. But, you know, it was fine. I slept well last night, and it was good.
Last couple of things, Larry. The stage. We better talk about cycling. Do you think Pogacar will try and win again today?
I would have thought yes, but I actually am leaning towards, I think it's going to be a breakaway today. Unless some, you know, guy who's way too close on the GC tries to go in and then messes it all up. I think it'll be a breakaway, but if for some reason the fight goes on super long, then maybe they'll try to win, you know, because why not if you only have to ride a little bit? But looking at, like, the start, the roads are pretty technical, actually, and I feel like the breakaway will go earlier than 60K in today, so.
Your stage is coming up, stage 12.
Yeah.
We decided this was your stage with Joe Dombrowski before the Giro. Have you got time for one more question, Larry?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just spoke to Alessandro De Marchi about, well, what he did yesterday, and he had a session with his mental coach. Are you speaking to your mental coach on the Giro? Did you yesterday?
I did, yeah, 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 yeah. Same.
I asked him, could he tell us one thing that he spoke to the mental coach about? And he talked about the breakaway that he was in on Saturday and how he kind of got frustrated in it. But on reflection, when they looked at his numbers, it was actually a lot better than he realized. And, you know, sort of working through that. What about you?
Yeah, for me, it was sort of more about, like, I don't know, trying to get the most out of myself. So, you know, I guess what I was saying was, like, I can't say I've actually suffered that much in this Giro because, like, I guess for me, the thing that's hard is, like, if you're not going in the breaks, finding an objective for yourself, you know, it's like because, okay, my job is to stay with Ben and put him in a good position. And then the thing is, like, I mean, I've been able to do that very well in this Giro. So, like, every place that he needs to be in good position, I've been able to put him, like, right at the front. And every time it's, like, boom, perfect. But, you know, then the thing is, like, wow. I mean, I'm at the bottom of, like, a 15K climb, and then, you know, I can just go easy, right? Where it's, like, I think it's... So I've been able to do that without really having to go super deep. And then it's, like, okay, well, I need to sort of start to make some objectives for myself as well. So, for example, you know, I don't know, today, you know, just... I mean, I don't know what's going to happen on the final climb, but... You know, why not just try to stay with him as long as I can, you know? So if I can be there till there's 20 guys left or something like that, you know? So it's like trying to set some objectives in the race that also, you know, can push myself sort of, you know? Because it's almost too easy to just, like, do your job and then just chill, you know? So, yeah, to get something out of it sort of for myself, which, I mean, it also benefits the team if I stay with Ben longer, right? So, yeah, that was sort of one thing we were focusing on. Sorry, that was a really long explanation. But yeah.
It's good. I mean, I'll tell Mara Venier in a minute that his Giro's too easy for Larry. Yeah. No, but, you know, the third week, Larry, I mean, being as fresh as possible at the end of the third week, that could be an objective, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, the one thing that I've seen is that not fighting like crazy every single day for the breakaway, I mean, I think I'm a hell of a lot fresher than I usually am. And it kind of has it's made me sort of reflect on, like, mistakes I've made in the past where, like, maybe I've tried too many days in a row or, you know, like, and then, you know, you're stressed because you don't make the breakaway and then, you know, it stresses you even more and then you try harder the next day and then, you know, you're, you know, using more energy. And it's kind of like, yeah, this spiral that can go one way or the other. And so I think, yeah, that's one thing I've realized is, like, damn, maybe actually every other Grand Tour I've done, I've just tried way too hard, way too frequently. Whereas, like, I think I'm realizing, like, I mean, and this sounds dumb because, like, I should have learned this a long time ago, and this is what normal people do, is, like, choose your days a lot more than I had in the past. So, it's been an interesting learning experience because... Yeah, it's the first time we've really had someone fighting for the podium of a team that I've been in. And so that's kind of cool.
You're fresco come una rosa, as they say in Italy. You're as fresh as a rose. Rosa is also the word for pink jersey. So who knows what might happen in the next few days, Larry. But keep doing what you're doing. You seem to be riding well. And, it just seems to be working.
Thanks. Yeah, sounds good.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Well, Brian, as already established, it was a rest day yesterday. We were staying in a place called Gragnano. We spent much of yesterday on the Amalfi Coast, which, as I explained a few days ago, was sort of missing from my, it's not really a bucket list, just a list of places in Italy. And I've been to most of them now because I've done... God knows how many Giro d'Italia. But I ticked that off yesterday, and there was a bit of talk in what you're about to hear, a bit of a sort of a vignette of our rest day. There's some talk about box ticking and the box ticking that can be travel and tourism.
Sono due o tre cose più tecniche, quindi le facciamo in italiano, ma questa tradizione della pasta, cioè, è soprattutto la qualità, il prestigio del prodotto, da dove deriva, nel senso, cioè, l'acqua, la farina, cos'è?
Allora, io dico sempre niente per caso. Gragnano è incastonato nei Monti Rattari, non affaccia sul mare, è vicino al mare. I am Ciro Punzo. I am the general manager of the pastificio a Feltra. We are in Gragnano, in the center of Gragnano. Gragnano is very famous for the pasta because in the 2013 we received the important PGI from the European Commission for the pasta di Gragnano. We produce pasta in this pastificio between 1848. Gragnano have a very, very long tradition in the pasta. Probably in Gragnano, the national sport is not the football, but it's the pasta. In every point of Gragnano, in the street, at the corner, out of the bar, in the square, the people speak about pasta. Sometimes son and father speak about pasta. I make probably the son work in a pastificio, Garofalo, the father at a Feltra, he speak about pasta. I make the best rigatoni. No, I make the best rigatoni. The spaghettoni have this diameter. No, this diameter. For this reason, the national sport in Gragnano is not the football or the ciclismo, but the pasta.
Ci siamo domandati cosa vorremmo noi da questa birra per scegliere lei e non un'altra birra. E qui l'abbiamo studiato un po' tutto. La scelta del vetro sia per la parte che è doppia.
My name is Pasquale Pacileo, I grew up in Amalfi. Che molte persone stanno convertendo le loro cose a B&B. Quindi le famiglie, soprattutto quelle emergenti che si stanno formando, non li hanno difficoltà.
Rest day number one at the Giro d'Italia brought me to Amalfi. I've got to say, when we first arrived, I wasn't finding it very restful because it's quite a stressful drive to get here. Any drive in this part of Italy is quite stressful. And then, well, when you arrive on the Amalfi coast, and this was no surprise, of course, it is overrun. And overrun is really the right word, with tourists. Yeah. And you can feel as though all of the sort of organic soul of this place has been sucked out by tourism. And I think my impression is, and we travel a lot, and I suppose we're hypocrites in a way, because often we're sort of exposing these places and we're inviting or encouraging people to come to these places. But my feeling is that this phenomenon has sort of accelerated in particular places over the last 4 years. You know, you've got this phenomenon of revenge tourism since COVID. And yeah. It's been written about widely that people are, every sort of summer feels like an essential opportunity to travel and kind of tick a box.
I got the feeling when I was walking from a Trani to here while you were parking the car, it felt like boarding an airplane. You know, you're just uncomfortably close to other people, everyone sort of on their own agenda, everyone's taking their Instagram photos or just documenting that they were here.
Yeah, and I think one thing that we should sort of specify, particularly with the Amalfi Coast, is this is a place with a history of tourism that goes back not just decades but centuries. I was reading about it earlier, and it sort of predates a lot of the tourism, for example, on the Ligurian coast, which I talked about in San Remo. You know, Goethe is often attributed with what sort of starting tourism here. The British arrived. The British apparently were very dominant in the Ravello, particularly. All sorts of kind of illustrious sort of thinkers, writers, musicians. Richard Wagner spent a lot of time in Amalfi, apparently.
The Krøyers, the P.S. and Maria Krøyer, the most famous Danish painters of that era, stayed here for months and months, and their paintings are some of the most important testimonies of what life used to be here, because they weren't tourists. She weren't at the time, they were travellers, painters and artists.
Brian, Richard Wagner's wife, who was described in a piece, an Italian piece I read earlier today about the history of tourism on the Amalfi Coast, she was described as a stuck-up Prussian. She referred to the locals in Amalfi as cannibals. Oh. So that gives you an idea that there has always been this sort of exploitative element to tourism and traveling, you know, people who come in and dip in and take what they can from a place and then leave.
Between the locals, people who live their everyday life, people who were born here, grew up here, and then the people who just pass by. And it's bound to be some kind of contrast of outlook on the world and people who are moving fast and people who, you know, for all kinds of reasons, have decided not to go anywhere. So it's never really a good match, especially if there's too much of one and too little of the other.
Brian, you mentioned locals. Well, we've just spoken to a couple of them, young locals and people who are relying on tourism, as most of the people who live here rely on tourism. And again, that's been the case, reading about the history of Amalfi, that's been the case for decades and decades. These gentlemen have set up their own brewery, Melfis.
It's the original Greek name of Amalfi. Interestingly, one of those two good fellows told me that the community Amalfi, they control who can use Amalfi as a brand. And they can't, they can only use it below their product, which is extraordinarily well made. And they call it Melfi from the old ancient Greek name of this place, La Birra di Amalfi.
The problems they were describing, Brian, and their also conflictedness, their problems that you hear in a lot of tourist destinations in Europe. And again, I feel as though this phenomenon has accelerated in the last 3 or 4 years with COVID, with smart working in particular, with the sort of, well, the increased awareness of where the most beautiful places in Europe are. And Instagram, I mean, people are very specific about the fact that Instagram has changed places like the Amalfi. And Pasquale and Andrea were also talking about Airbnb, which is, it's given rise to huge opportunities in a lot of places, but it's also caused huge problems with the housing market, and here is no different. A lot of their friends have had to leave, or a lot of their friends' families have had to leave. They can no longer afford to live here. And when you ask people for solutions, what is the solution? They sort of, well, they kind of shrug, and we're all at a bit of a loss.
Yeah, I know it from where I live, which is in Versilia, which is the Riviera of Tuscany of sorts, and then with Forte di Marmi next by, it's you have sort of the contrast between the summer months from now on, you know, Giro time of year until the end of September, and it's like night and day. You know, winters are very quiet and the summers are too loud, so it kind of like it tears a little bit the wear and the tear on the identity, especially for the people who live here. And the children who grow up here, I think it can be a bit schizophrenic or binary in how they identify with the place. And, you know, everyone travels away to come back again at some point, but I'm not sure everyone would recognize it if they stayed away for a few years and then came back here.
So, Brian, that was us on the pasta trail,
visit. To be fair, this is a 3-week pasta trail, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, my visit to the Premiato Pastificio.
I was actually the first one there.
You were, but you didn't get an audience with the manager.
No, I just made my suitcase, I think 7 kilos heavier.
With Ciro Punzo, who we heard from there, saying that pasta was the national sport in Gragnano, home of about 40-odd pasta makers, pastifici. Brian, Ciro did give me some good tips, as well as obviously buying feltra pasta. He said the most common mistake that foreigners make is they put the pasta in the water before they even start boiling it.
What?
Boiling it. I've never done that, I must admit.
And also, if you didn't mention it, as salt as the Mediterranean. My rule of thumb is 1 liter for the pot, and 1 liter per 100 grams, and don't like put like butter or oil in afterwards. Maybe if you're having a sauce, leave a little bit of pasta water for the sauce, and then you're good to go. And always taste it, not always cook it as it says on the box.
No, I agree with that. I do agree with that. I mean, you should always taste your food a lot more than you think is necessary. That's a good tip from me. It applies to risottos as well. I talked about risottos earlier in the Giro. And Brian, Ciro also told me about why Gragnano has become its mecca for pasta. Obviously, it's a long tradition, but where did it come from? What's special about Gragnano? You know, we often talk about this, like the microclimate and the very subtle wind on the Via Roma in Milan San Remo. And there's all sorts been written and speculated about the wilds of Via Roma in San Remo. Well, the main street in Gragnano is called the Via Roma. And Ciro said the Via Roma itself has a sort of special microclimate the sense the cool air comes up from the sea and has a kind of backdrop to Gragnano, the Monti Latari, which I mentioned earlier, the mountains, and this all creates the perfect conditions on the Via Roma specifically for essiccation. I don't even know the English word. The drying, the drying of the pasta, and then of course they use the mountain water, and these two things, as well as the know-how that's been handed down over generations.
That makes sense.
Lead to, well, the sign when you go into Gragnano, it says European Capital of Pasta. The Feltra Pastificios, they've got a sign above their door saying University of Pasta. You'll find, I mean, often Gragnano
pasta, you'll recognize it. It looks kind of matte rather than glossy. It almost looks like it's coated in a kind of powder. It's not, it's quite rough, coarse looking. But in Italy, it is considered the sort of best pasta you can buy. Brian, we found out some more things about Gragnano just as we were leaving.
I almost scared you off your morning run.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a part of Italy, and we've talked about this a lot in the past, mafia and organized crime, and there are a lot of stereotypes to do with it, but Gragnano itself has had its problems. There was a very well-publicized case a couple of years ago, a local boss, Antonio Di Martino, in December 22. He'd been on the run for a couple of years, and he was found sort of in a mountain bunker, fully clothed, wearing his hiking boots with a wig and sunglasses sort of on the bedside table, so obviously ready to go, ready to escape. And this bunker was accessed via a sort of secret passageway in a home further down the hill in Gragnano. You sent me some links this morning. There have been murders, Camorra, that's the sort of Neapolitan mafia. There have been sort of murders in Gragnano even in the last 3 or 4 years. So, you know, a little bit of a dark side. But you often find that in southern Italy, you know, the wonderful and the beautiful and the appealing and, you know, the tradition of the pasta making alongside a slightly more sinister side.
Well, the mafia hunter number one, Niccolo Gracieri, who spent most of his life chasing down mafia criminals and put a bunch of Pugliese mafia in prison, he is now head of the anti-mafia section of Napoli, and hence Campania, and hence also the battle against the Camorra. So a lot of Italians are expecting some major changes in how they will be prosecuted. That's at least the hopes around here.
And Brian, the other part of that little montage we heard, well, it sort of encapsulated a similar juxtaposition of the beautiful and the wonderful and the appealing and a slightly more equivocal side of the same phenomenon. And I'm talking about tourism. We were in the Amalfi yesterday and we heard a bit there from the chaps at the Melfis microbrewery. A couple of young gentlemen have set up this wonderful microbrewery there, and they are unashamedly, as everyone is pretty much in Amalfi, they're targeting tourists, and they're doing very well by all accounts, and they've got, well, it's beautifully packaged, beautifully presented beer, and you tasted some, tastes really good as well. And we also heard from Pasquale there, and the story that they tell is one of conflictedness, really, about relying on tourism, relying on it more and more, tourism exploding there largely, or well, partly in the Amalfi, particularly in the last 3 or 4 years, due to TV series, due to Instagram, just the sort of diffusion of information about these places. And a lot of the locals, a lot of the guys that they went to school with are being sort of forced out, priced out, can no longer rent apartments and so on and so forth. And it is a bit of a head scratcher. And this is a sort of debate and an issue that's been played out in a lot of places in Europe and indeed across the world, isn't it, Brian?
You know, there's this thing that all of those places, be it Positano, Amalfi, a lot of places in Rome, Lake Como, those are all places and destinations people go to because it looks amazing. But then when they go there, the atmosphere sort of implodes because they're there with a million other people coming for the same thing. So it loses its magic. And I mean, a lot of people desperately trying to find that one little angle that hasn't been exposed in photographies on social media. So it is a bit, I mean...
We should all stop
pushes
taking
the agenda
pictures.
Pushes the agenda of local identity as well. As we heard from those guys.
Instead of sort of pointing our phones out of the window, Brian, while we're leisure driving around the Amalfi Coast, we should be throwing those phones into the Mediterranean. That's what we should have been doing yesterday.
I have thought about that more than once.
Brian, it's time for...
La tappa di domani e la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Brian, yesterday's dinner, well, we went to...
We didn't go together.
No, we didn't go. We ended up, we bumped into each other in the local pizzeria. There wasn't a lot opening Gragnano last night. I, of course, wanted to eat the local pasta, which we had the previous night, and it was excellent. Last night, we both ended up in a pizzeria. There's a famous type of... It's kind of like a pizza that is very particular, specific to... I think unique to Gragnano, called the panuozzo. And it's basically... I mean... a lot of fuss was made about this panuoto, but it's basically a kind of pizza sandwich. It's a pizza sandwich, but I can't really judge because I didn't have one, and the locals were raving about them. So really, I should have done that. So that was what we had. You had a pizza as well.
The place was called the Temple.
It was.
We went and kneeled down to the altar of the panuoto.
And Brian, briefly, tomorrow's stage.
Very briefly, Daniel. Tomorrow's stage is a longer one. Well, it wouldn't take much to be longer than today. It's 207 kilometers from Foiano di Val Fortore and all the way to the east side of the Italian peninsula on the Adriatic coast, Francavilla al Mare, very close to where the Giro started last year, close to Pescara. So we'll be basically crossing the entire length of the country in 2 days.
I think we might be in four regions tomorrow. I think we're definitely going to be in three. I think we are in certainly Puglia for like a couple of kilometers, maybe Molise.
San Salvo, I think, is in
Abruzzo.
No, in Abruzzo, sorry.
So it might be three. It could even be four because we may start in Campania. Brian, I think that's enough for tonight.
Sounds good.
Buonasera.
Buonasera.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.